Welcome to Your Life Reset, a Virta Health podcast series. I'm your host, Teresa Link, and in this series, we'll hear from people on their Virta journey, the wins, failures, moments of adversity, and moments of joy they're experiencing along the way. So sit back, relax, and listen as we unwrap the truly human experience of Virta. Hey there, listeners. I'm Teresa Link, and welcome back to another episode of Your Life Reset. Today's guests are some of the most fascinating minds, challenging everything we thought we knew about cholesterol, metabolism, and ketosis. Dr. Nick Norwitz is a researcher and educator on a mission to make metabolic health mainstream. After reversing his own inflammatory disease through a ketogenic diet, he went on to earn his PhD at Oxford and pursue his medical degree at Harvard. Then we have Dave Feldman, a software engineer turned cholesterol investigator. He made waves with his self-experiments. He's become a leading voice in the lipid world. And finally, Dr. Adrian Soto is a physician and researcher who obtained his PhD from Oxford. He had a focus on metabolism and evidence-based medicine. His work combines clinical expertise with data science to rethink metabolic health from the ground up. These three aren't just asking bold questions. They are changing the conversation. Let's dive in. Well, Nick, Dave, and Adrian, I am beyond excited to have you all here today. You are not just the voices in the ketogenic space, but you're actually shaking things up and challenging the status quo, like in a really, really massive way. So today we're actually going to start, or we're going to focus at least somewhat on your recently published study that's called Keto CTA Study, Plaque Begets Plaque, ApoB Does Not. Quite a mouthful. But before we get to that juicy stuff, just give us a little bit of a backstory. You know, how did each of you get into this space? How did your paths cross? So Nick, we can start with you.
Sure. I mean, if you were to have told me when I was starting my academic career that I'd be anywhere in the nutrition and diet space, I would have laughed at you. Like, I was, you know, the kid in college should go with my friends to like smash pasta and cookies after we go to try practice or something. But for better or worse, at the end of college and at the beginning of grad school, I started suffering from inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis in particular. And I'll leave out the gory details, but long story short, my path mirrored what I think a lot of people in this space path follows, which is you try a conventional approach. You truly try all the frontline therapies and nothing works. So you start getting desperate and you start experimenting with different things. So that's how I found a ketogenic diet. This was in 2019 at Oxford, which is actually where I met Adrian. And I was in and out of the hospital with inflammatory bowel disease, really desperate, trying different diets. I tried keto and my disease went into remission, which was incredible. But then something weird happened, which was despite eating a form of keto that is what I think a lot of people with a conventional mindset would deem as looking healthy. So like, you know, not much meat or dairy, lots of leafy greens, avocado, fatty fish, that kind of thing. My cholesterol, in particular, my LDL, quote, bad cholesterol, because that's what I teach us in medical school, shot through the roof. It went from, if I use the US units, milligrams per deciliter, around 90 to well over 300. Which made me scared, but also intensely curious about, like, you know, what was going on? Why was this happening? So I started to go down the rabbit hole of literature, except the rabbit hole didn't really go anywhere. There really wasn't much in this phenomenon, which made me even more curious. My dad always raised me to be like, you know, ask the hard questions, and if you can't get a good answer, that means it's a good question, so keep digging. And so that's what brought me to Dave, because Dave had a similar experience just a few years prior. He was coming at from it from a you know, kind of different vantage point. And so I stumbled upon his stuff, which wasn't in the typical academic sphere. It wasn't in the peer-reviewed literature, but it was fascinating to me, some of his ideas. So I'll pass it off to him to give his backstory and then to Adrian as well. How it kind of came together.
Yeah, thanks,
how
Nick.
I came to date.
Dave, over to you.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was 2015. 2015 was when I, for the second year in a row, I'd gotten an A1C of 6.1. So knowing that it would be indicative of pre-diabetes, I was concerned that I was following the route of my own family, that unfortunately type 2 diabetes is quite rampant. So I adopted a ketogenic diet to avoid progressing towards further and further insulin resistance. And yes, like Nick, saw my cholesterol go up. Also, like Nick, a few years earlier, there just was not that much information on it. And so at that point in time, I went ahead and started doing a number of experiments to see how static my cholesterol levels were. How much did it really come back to this diet? And found that it was very dynamic. And that kind of unlocked a lot of curiosity for me. So I started the cholesterolkode.com blog, where I started sharing what I was finding. And a lot of other people on social media would then get back to me with their experiences as well. And it turned out to be a fairly common phenomenon. And eventually in time, I would find that not only did many of us see our LDL go up, the so-called bad cholesterol, but on top of that, HDL cholesterol, often referred to as the good cholesterol, would go up, and triglycerides would go down. And both of those tend to be associated with better cardiovascular disease risk. So this was very odd. But these three together comprised this phenotype that I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot, known as lean mass hyperresponders. And then ultimately, it would be just a few years later that I would spearhead putting together this study that we'll be talking about. And not long after that was when I connected with both Nick and the last person of our trio, Adrian Sotomoda, who will end up being the first author to this paper that we're going to be talking about. I'm so excited. So I'll pass it off to you, Adrian.
Yes, Adrian, your turn.
I think that's a good cue, because I ended up here by saying, hey, that's kind of strange. I don't, in contrast with many people in the low carb space, I have been privileged enough and I've enjoyed mostly good health all my life. I didn't arrive here because I was trying to solve a disease or anything like that. I knew of Dave Feldman and his That's Kind of Strange stuff before he knew about me. And actually, what I remember is the thing that made me, you know, perhaps raise my eyebrows the most when I learned about Dave was how he described LDL can go up, but then very quickly down, and then up, and then down, and then up, and then down, especially with an explanation or a mechanism that seemed plausible. I would say, I would use a different adjective now, but was unconventional. So these, hey, LDL is going up and down and up and down and up and down, and we really don't have good physiology to explain up and down and up and down. Hey, that's kind of strange. And that's how I ended up here. By background, I am a clinician. I am a clinical researcher. Nick already told you about how we met. And in parallel, I trained and developed expertise as a data analyst. And that's my grain of salt in this data analysis.
Well, thanks, Adrian. Thanks to all three of you for giving us that little bit of a background. One common theme also that I am seeing is the curiosity and the use of data and how that is driving all of your experiments and what has been driving you to want to research this more. So Adrian, thank you for rounding us out. Dave, I'm going to ask you another question. So again, we've got super exciting news for our listeners. A study that dropped only a few weeks ago, the Keto CTA study, plaque begets plaque, ApoB does not. So before we really talk about what you all found as the researchers, let's review some of these terms just so we all kind of know what we're talking about here. So what do plaque, LDL-C, and ApoB mean? And then how are they different from each other, Dave?
Yeah, that takes a little bit of unpacking. Let's just say that the body has a reason to move things around in your blood to get them to your cells. And if it's a lipid is by definition, it's effectively a kind of fat that is what you'd call hydrophobic or water fearing. And so the body, in order to get it into your bloodstream, which is water-based, it needs a carrier. And so it makes these complexes that are a mixture of lipids and proteins, appropriately called lipoproteins. And so when we're talking about LDL, that's a kind of lipoprotein, the most prominent version of an ApoB-containing lipoprotein, which has cholesterol inside it. So when you're getting your LDL cholesterol, what you're getting is, for a certain unit of blood, the amount of cholesterol found on these complexes, these ApoB-containing lipoproteins. Now, I say ApoB-containing because that's the major protein that's on the outside that's integrated into it. And there's exactly one copy of an ApoB for every one of these vehicles, if you will, that carry around the lipids in your blood. Now,
could we imagine that ApoB is like a little tiny boat floating through, and then the LDLC is like a passenger in that boat? Does that make sense?
Yes, that's very close. We would say ApoB is like, you know, a major component of that boat. It's not itself the boat.
It's the hull. I don't know.
What's that?
I could say it's the hull. It's like a key component that is the foundation.
Yes,
but there are other components.
Because importantly, there is only one ApoB per boat.
Okay.
So this is a meaningful difference between other metrics of blood lipids.
It is. And while we're here, it is kind of important to draw attention to the fact that for quite literally several decades, LDLC, LDL cholesterol, has been the primary focus, especially by lipidologists and cardiologists. It's very easy to get through a lipid panel, the standard lipid panel that gives you the HDL and the triglycerides. It's fairly easy to calculate when you've got these other lipid levels. But more and more, and especially in the last few years, there's been an interest in specifically looking to ApoB because it's thought to be better with regard to, it doesn't just look at LDL particles, the ones that have LDL cholesterol, but also other what are considered to be atherogenic particles like VLDL or chylomicron remnants. So we won't get into all of that. We'll just say that that's why we were especially interested in how much ApoB was associating with plaque. So getting to the plaque now, it is the present-day lipid hypothesis that the greater concentration of ApoB-containing lipoproteins like LDL drives the process of developing plaque in the arteries. So the higher your LDL, almost certainly the higher your ApoB, and presumably the more there'll be a correlation with the development of plaque in the arteries. And to be fair, this does have other components that exacerbated, but that's the present day was lipid hypothesis today.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Nick, over to you. What is it that you were trying to learn from this study? What did you want to find out? What questions did you have that you said, we need the answers for?
Sure. So as Dave nicely explained, there's this idea that the higher your ApoB-containing particle count is, and in this case, for the listener, you can kind of think as ApoB and LDL cholesterol is running in parallel for all purposes. If LDL is super, super high, your ApoB is going to be high as well. There can be discrepancies, but for the most part, and here, you know, you can think of these things as correlated. The idea is if you have exceptionally high LDL, it should just drive cardiovascular disease. However, there are, let's say, types of evidence that haven't been yet collected to test that model in its strongest sense. So what you'd really want to test is you'd want a human circumstance that is devoid of other factors like metabolic disease or a broken underlying lipid metabolism. Because there's lots of different reasons any different biomarker can go up, be it cholesterol or even something as gross as height. You know, you can be tall because you have tall parents. You can be tall because of a brain tumor secreting growth hormone. They have different consequences because they had different causes. And so what we found here in this lean mass hyperresponder population that we're studying is the first human circumstance where LDL cholesterol and ApoB are very, very high, but there's not an underlying background of insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome like most of the population. And there's also not like a clear genetic cause, like the lipid receptor is broken, which is one other cause of very high LDL. But this is different. People that are lean mass hyperresponders, like me, we're not born with very high LDL. It is a metabolic response to a change in the environment, in this case, carbohydrate restriction. So it presents a very interesting natural experiment where we can say, well, let me partition the questions into kind of two categories. There's the mechanistic question, why does this happen? And then there's the question of risk. We can talk about the mechanism, I think, a little bit later if we want. But with respect to risk, a question arises is like, well, is this dangerous? And to what extent? Because you can accept the idea that, you know, LDL particles are part of the pathway of atherogenesis, the formation of these plaques and arteries. But it doesn't necessarily follow that higher is always dangerous and that the same high level in different people commits the same degree of risk. It's very contextualized. So what we had in this population was an exceptional group of people where we could take these super, super high levels and see what happens to plaque over time. The prevailing hypothesis would suspect that there is a dose response relationship to higher ApoB, higher LDL and plaque progression. So the higher the ApoB, the higher the LDL, the more plaque you accumulate because you have more exposure. So that was one of the things we were testing and what we were interested in.
All right. Thank you very much. And how did you find these folks, these 100 lean, metabolic healthy people? Who are these hyper responders? Did you have just a bunch of people that came to you or a bunch of people that commented on you know, posts? How did you learn about these folks?
Yeah, so obviously this is where we have to thank social media. We have to thank the internet because we started a Facebook group back in 2018, the Lean Mass Hyperresponder Facebook group. And I say reluctantly because I can't say as a technologist that I'm in love with Facebook as a platform. It's not the best, frankly, but it is where a lot of people are and where they like to post. So we went ahead and started it. As of today, we have 13,500 members. So it's a lot of folks out there who are either themselves lean mass hyperresponders or close to it, or those who are just interested in the science and are exploring this right now. And from that group became one of the major areas for which we could do recruitment. Of course, all three of us, but particularly Nick and I, were very active on social media, especially X/Twitter. That's also another place where we were able to recruit a lot of folks. And there was quite a few who applied. I want to say maybe one in four ended up being a participant. But I was excited because not only did we get our recruitment goal of all 100 participants registering, but all of them completed the study as well. So we had a very high retention relative to other studies of the same type.
I wish that I knew about this Facebook group in 2018. I'm definitely joining it now because I am a hyper responder and my doctor is very worried about my LDL cholesterol. And I say, yeah, but my triglycerides, they're like 35. And my HDL is like 82. I mean, why is this an issue? Well, your cholesterol is really high. So I'm really interested. I'm definitely going to join it. Please let me in. And I can't wait to meet other people in this space and hear what they're all chatting about. So that's really cool that you had so many people that were interested in this and wanting to be part of the study.
Well, and I'll say one other thing in favor of that group that I appreciate is, very early on, we set the tone that we wanted to be more science-centric than advocacy-centric. So there are many people who are concerned about lean mass hyperresponders and advocate for taking steps to lower LDL. So it's not what you might consider an echo chamber of just one opinion that might be leaning in one direction. And we champion that. You know, we want it to be a place where there can be a lot of productive discussion. It, not just about other studies, but about our studies. You know, we want to invite a critique that continues to move the conversation forward.
Fantastic. From here, the three of you, is there a direction that you want to go?
I I would actually love to direct to Adrian the discussion on especially the association with LDL and ApoB with plaque. What were the findings of the paper? With him being first author, he's well suited to give us some feedback on that.
So the thing I would add to what Dave and Nick already mentioned is that it is actually at the same time rare, but at the same time surprisingly easy to find people who met these criteria. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. Because on one hand, if you look at pretty much all studies in modern lipidology, or 99% of the studies that have been published in lipidology for the last four decades, in pretty much every case, when you saw high LDL, it was in someone with insulin resistance or with a genetic disorder that caused high LDL. So it was rare to see high LDL in isolation. And Dave Feldman basically found a recipe to get high LDL in isolation. And that recipe was, if you are lean and you restrict carbohydrates, we can expect to see high LDL without the context that prevails in most published lipidology studies. On the other hand, participants in this study had to prove they had been on the diet for quite a long time, that their lipids before the diet were what would be considered to be normal, and had to agree to bleed every single day for 1 year to demonstrate they were adhering to the diet. This is not something you see every day in a dietary study. Whenever you read a dietary study on the Mediterranean diet, you and the researchers, the reader and the researchers, trust that people said they adhere, trust what people said. Trust that if they were supposed to eat a Mediterranean diet, they did. And if they were supposed to don't eat a Mediterranean diet, they didn't. Same applies for any other dietary pattern you can think of. The only one you can actually test for adherence is a ketogenic diet. And this is especially important because, of course, I mean, we will go to the main findings in a bit, but we couldn't be sure of these findings if we weren't sure people were following the diet they said or they were supposed to follow. I mean, just imagine these findings without dietary pattern certainty. You just cannot be sure you can attribute or you can dissect effects. Now, when you take this group of people that are not frequent in today's world, because in today's world, 90% of citizens in the Western world have at least one marker of insulin resistance. They're not frequent, but they are not aliens. You know, they have normal physiology. They have a working metabolism. I would highlight four main findings. First of all, you would still see variability in their plaque response. Some will have more plaque progression than others. And this is really not surprising. This is true for any clinical category you build. Some people with diabetes do better than others. Some people with hypertension do better than others. Some people with cancer do better than others. So not because you have a well-defined population means you shouldn't expect variability. So message number one, there is variability. Message number two, this variability is explained, predicted by how much plaque there was in the first place. And this is not only, I mean, some people say or have interpreted that, yeah, well, of course, if you left your home 10 minutes late for your appointment, you can predict you will be late to your appointment. This is not the case because we have biological reasons to know that there is a priming effect, that plaque there will get you in a compound effect, more plaque. So it's more like an investment with compound interest than simply saying, you know, your when did you leave your home? Will you be late? So plaque is a very good predictor for how much plaque there will be after 1 year. The
Can
main
I jump
suspect,
in there, Adrian, just to clarify
sure.
something.
Sure, sure.
So the analogy you brought up that has been, I guess, one point of criticism. If you leave your house sooner, you kind of get a head start, you'll arrive at work sooner. This isn't about just the endpoint, but also the change. So the appropriate analogy would be, if you leave your house sooner, would you then drive further in this same time frame? It's not about where you end up per se, it's about actually how much change there is. And like Adrian said, there are many examples in physiology where we get these positive feedback loops where, say, cancer begets cancer. You have a seed of something and then it grows. So this idea that the seed of the plaque kind of starts to snowball is one, a very important one, and two, a very biologically sound one. I just wanted to make that emphasis.
That is absolutely true.
Can I add one more thing? And to be fair, we're not claiming that there aren't things that are yet to be discovered that could better explain why the plaque increases beyond the variables we're even looking at or that anybody is looking at. We still don't know, and modern cardiologists who research this will concede there's still some unknown factors as to why some people have plaque that develops rapidly and some do not, beyond what is clearly evident from what we're looking for. And we're no difference. The question that's germane is, how much can you determine from the first scan enough information to make a prediction on the progression? And our data supports that you can, from the first scan, look at present plaque that's presented, and it will associate with a greater rate of increase. And that's a huge and important thing that supports a lot of existing data that's out there right now.
And what I would emphasize here.
Sure. It just, the really important thing here that Dave just alluded to is the idea of us not knowing, the medical community not knowing, that there are differences, as Adrian used the term heterogeneity, in how people respond to different diets, plaque progression with different biomarkers. And what we need is a curiosity about why there are those differences. So sure, you can say at a population level, if you take all 8 billion people or so, and you look at ApoB levels, lower levels tend to associate with less plaque and heart disease. But what I find so much more interesting, and I think I can speak for my colleagues here too, are those people who have LDL levels of 600 for a decade and have zero plaque, because they abut against the status quo, the basic model. It doesn't mean that model is wrong, but it does mean it has a major blind spot. And as curious scientists, what we need to do is say, what's going on in that person? Because in studying them or the population from which they come, we have a lot to learn that can then be generalized to knowledge that can help people. All right, now back to Adrian. Sorry, Adrian.
No, what I was going to say, more or less in the same direction, is that this is also not controversial. I mean, the idea of plaque getting more plaque has been observed multiple times in multiple studies with different methods. So first and second message are not controversial. There is variability. This is expected. Plaque getting more plaque, this is also expected. What's unexpected is the things Nick was alluding to. That if you take any person with an LMHR phenotype, you know, as you already described, is your case, and go to their doctor, and let's say you see plaque progression. You do see some plaque progression because you have two scans. The first suspect is going to be the high LDL. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's your high LDL. Let's lower your LDL with any of these interventions, and things should be better. Well, not so fast, because if anything, this paper highlights that you cannot simply blame high LDL for that plaque progression. Perhaps there's something else going on. It could be other risk factors beyond the lipid panel that explain better that plaque progression. And in medicine, we should be very careful when we think we found an answer, because when we think we found an answer, we stop looking for other alternative answers. If I simply blame the easy suspect, oh, it must be your cholesterol, I may miss a larger villain in my patient's plaque progression. So that's why it's so important to identify what drives and what doesn't drive, not only because it allows you to identify who you should be more careful with. Let's say, for example, I find a patient with high baseline plaque, well, now I know I want to see a second plaque measurement sooner. If I find a patient with no plaque at all, maybe I will be less intensive in following how much plaque there is. If I find that plaque is progressing, and now I know I shouldn't be so quickly in judging or attributing that plaque progression to LDL, then, you know, I will start looking, hey, do you have inflammation? Is your blood pressure under control? Are you smoking? Are you, you know, all the other things beyond the lipid panel that we know contribute to plaque progression. So we should be very, very careful when we think we found an answer. Is the things yet that you think you know but don't what gets you into trouble? So that's the other message. And perhaps the fourth main finding is, yeah, with what we know so far, with the metrics we've analyzed so far, getting cardiac imaging on plaque is especially useful. This is clinically actionable right now. I mean, if not only for people with an LMHR, I mean, CAC scores have been gaining popularity for all patients in recent years. So yeah, I mean, this reinforces the clinical utility of getting a coronary artery calcium score.
So, Adrian, if you're my physician, and I generally am having the characteristics of a hyper responder, which I, you know, I do. Generally, it's not something that I have felt like I've been concerned about. But if I want to find out my baseline plaque amount in my arteries and how that progresses, is that something I could do outside of a research setting?
Sure. Actually, many have already documented one, two more plaque assessments. They are, I mean, a calcium score is cheaper than, you know, the methods used in this study, because this study, I mean, was really about being as sensible as possible, as sensitive as possible to detect plaque changes. So it used, you know, state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line methods to detect plaque changes. But calcium artery coronary scores are easily available and should be around, well, I mean, of course, it depends on the provider, but you can estimate $100 and you can get one in many places. In most cities. So I think, yeah, that's clinically actionable. Some people, let me say this, for some people, CAC scores won't be as reliable. If you are younger than 40 years old, well, then not because you see a CAC score of 0 means you are absolutely off the hook. If you are younger than 40 and don't see a CAC score of 0, well, that's already, you know, telling you that perhaps you need to pay attention to something else. But if you are above 40, if you are older than 40 years old, CAC scores are replicable, fairly cheap, and easy to obtain. For those who have a higher risk and in whom, for example, could be useful to know where is plaque, because it's not the same, you know, not all arteries in your heart are equally crucial. And if you're someone who perhaps would need intervention, well, then you definitely need coronary artery tomographies, angiotomographies. And so the test, I mean, as always, talk to your doctor. I mean, speak to your primary healthcare provider. What's your case? What's best for you? Which type of plaque scan is the most adequate for you? But yeah, I mean, this reinforces the clinical utility plaque metrics have been showing in recent years.
That's very practical advice. Thank you. I know a lot of our listeners would want to know, okay, well, I'm not in this research study. How can I actually look at this? And there's a clear way that you can get it done. Of course, talk to your own physician, but that's very helpful to know. I am over 40, so I'm probably going to do it. And for my own, you know, my own, curiosity, and also just to make sure that things are lining up with the way I anticipate they are. So thank you again for that.
What I'd like to emphasize, if we're not going to go into all the nuances and rebuttals, is a couple things. One, the main interesting finding in our minds that the prediction, or what predicts plaque regression, is plaque, not ApoB, hasn't really been legitimately challenged. Dave and Adrian, would you disagree with that point. I'm sure we could, like, I mean, we can come up with things people have said, but I don't think there's actually been any legitimate challenge to that core point, which is what we talked about thus far.
I would say the one, if I'm trying to steel man the position of detractors, there's this, I'm going to call it the saturation hypothesis. There are some who are saying the plaque increase observed cohort wide in our study is because they all, and I would see phrases like this, they all had a high LDL. And that once they all have high LDL, then the lack of association between ApoB and plaque is not relevant because it's saturated. This is frankly a kind of a new hypothesis because that's not the present lipid hypothesis. You can look at the very famous 2017 consensus paper. It says quite clearly that it's in a dose dependent level. It's not just linear, it's log linear. You often hear the lower, the longer, the better, because it's thought to be the same in reverse. And so with respect to our well-meaning, you know, critiques, that the two do need to be reconciled in some fashion, particularly if you're looking at a pronounced change. So that's, I want to say, maybe my best steel man version of that form of the pushback. The other more interesting thing that we're exploring right now is that our data sets could use some further examination, and that the semi-quantitative and the quantitative are a little bit different with regard to how they interact with each other compared to other studies. But we can't speak too much to that just yet.
Yeah, this, first of all, to the idea of a saturation effect, if somebody's actually proposing that as the counter argument, it is a stronger argument against the standing model than even what we propose. So it kind of shoots itself in the foot. But I think the other thing I'd like to emphasize, if we aren't to get just into the drama, and in a very short time frame, what might end up being like a he said, she said, is, you know, I'm not old, but I've been in academia long enough to know how these things generally roll out in an academic setting, as does Adrian. And, you know, when you have data and put it out there, it's not the be all end all. It's not the, I put the stamp on this and it's done. It's like, this is an evolving story. And so this is always going to be an evolving story. What's been really interesting to me is how, because things were so spring-loaded about this very controversial area, people started, one, presenting some criticisms. There's always fair criticisms, and we're happy to respond to those. But how that got intermingled with what is just like vitriol and speculation and attacks that I just find interesting socially to see how things spiraled. Now, what we're doing, and I think it's fair to say this is chosen to work, you know, with the journal behind the scenes to do things through professional channels. So some people have written letters to the editor, which we're happy to respond to and have academic discourse. What I struggle with, and now I'm just being transparent to you as like a, you know, a young academic and somebody who engages on social media, is, you know, the best way to walk the line between communicating publicly on the nuances and going through the quote appropriate academic channels. I'm going to say this, maybe Dave won't be happy that I said this, but I'm going to say this, which is, it's been very, very frustrating to try to balance those things because people have been jumping to conclusions that are just kind of a little bit absurd. In fact, while we were on this call, I was just kind of scrolling through because there's been comments like every day. And to see people get like pedantic and make assumptions, Simon Hill just posted one thing that I think was kind of like, well, entirely off base. And it's like, do you want to get into a public skirmish around these things, and to what degree? And it's been really difficult to navigate and actually have productive dialogues and then differentiate the criticisms that are constructive between the ones that are just like, you know, giving oxygen to the fire of social media. Sorry, that was a lot. And I know I'm speaking vaguely. I'm trying to kind of make generalizable statements about the difficulty of communicating science in this day and age. Dave and Adrian, anything to add?
I'll just add this little bit of meta. The little bit of meta is literally right at the moment that we're recording this. We have on deck a bunch of things we want to release to the public that helps advance the conversation. Unfortunately, we've committed also to be working within the process of the traditional journal, publication of the reply to a letter to the editor, because that kind of contains a crucial piece of information that they would like for us to be interacting with their version on. And it's just a challenge to expand on what Nick has described. Easily one of the most difficult things right now, from my perspective, coming from technology as an engineer, is I'm used to things rapidly shifting quickly, entire spaces getting torn down and rebuilt into a new image overnight. Like, that's just stock and standard. Social media helped us build this study. It helped us build the community the study is built on. And yet at the same time, there's just no getting around the fact that when we're interacting with the very, I hope you guys don't mind my saying, a very archaic publication of science, it's honestly, it's been a state of, I'm just going to be very open, it's been a state of madness that I know my two colleagues here have probably not seen me go through like it has been in the last few weeks. But we're doing our best. We're doing our best to try to partner with everyone as best as we can, work within this larger and larger coalition. And yet at the same time, we want to engage in this larger form of truth seeking. It'd be nice if it didn't have to be so complicated.
To an extent, you don't, like, what was it last week, Dave? We were up, I think it was 2 a.m. my time, 11 p.m. your time, because neither of us were like could sleep, and we were just putting together like a time capsule that we might release in 10 years about just like the utter drama that is, you wouldn't think it could occur in science to the degree that it does. Like, it makes soap operas look tame behind the scenes. And a lot of the things we just can't talk about it, nor is it necessarily pertinent to the general public. But one thing that I find interesting and terrifying is the true challenges and complexities that arise when we have this incursion of academia and the general public through social media, which we're seeing in real time now in the 2020s and going on. It's a very powerful tool for good as well. I mean, the only reason this research happened is because of social media. The fact that Dave was able to crowdsource a study off of enthusiasm from social media is quite incredible. At the same time, there are huge communication complexities that we're navigating or trying to navigate. And it's not easy. Yeah, it's probably the hardest part of the research, actually.
We are on the bleeding edge here, folks. May 7th, 2025, the comments are still coming in, and it is live and active. And as you said, exciting, frustrating. And you guys are just doing the best you can to have a constructive conversation and help people help answer their questions. And, you know, one thing that I just appreciate so much is your commitment to stay curious, as well as your commitment to continue to say, we don't have all of the answers, and that's okay. Dave, do you want me to, I thought maybe we could put in a plug for your documentary, unless you don't want to, like, coming up, what do you think?
Yeah, it's the Cholesterol Code, and there's a cholesterolcodemovie.com, but what's fascinating is it's a documentary that was effectively wrapped. And a lot of the more recent events were kind of wanting to add as an additional chapter that's going to be edited onto the end of it, or it might actually encapsulate it a little bit more. I don't know. It's kind of exciting, but it's also one of the tricks, or I should say challenges, with a documentary is when a story is unfolding, but there's even more interesting things that are coming up as you're getting close to premiere. You go, do we want to add that too? Can we really not? And so this is, the hope is that we were going to premiere it in the fall, but it may be that we need to open up the edit and put this on to the end, or, you know, integrate it throughout and then have that incorporate as well.
Yeah, it's like, where do you draw the line? Where do you just decide, okay, we're good, we're gonna release this, knowing there's so much more to, you know, so much more to come. And again, this is called the Cholesterol Code. You anticipate maybe this fall, maybe later. And so very excited to see when that does get released and where we'll be able to watch that. And I'll certainly be telling everyone I know to tune into that very, very exciting project. All right, we're looking to close out this very, very complex and very, very exciting and very cutting edge conversation today with Nick and Dave and Adrian. Again, thanks so much for being on. Let's pretend each of you get your very own billboard in the middle of Los Angeles or whatever large city you want. What statement do you want to put on that billboard?
Nothing beats the physical detection of the disease itself. Get a scan if you're concerned.
I like it.
That would be my billboard.
Remember, there are risk factors beyond the lipid panel. This will be true regardless if you have an LMHR lipid pattern or not.
I think I would be, you are a biochemical individual. Don't accept platitudes as good enough for you.
These were all fabulous and they're all different. Each billboard gets to have a giant face of each of you on it. So get ready for that. We're going to spend tons of money and get these billboards up. Just kidding. I wish I had all of that to do. So fellas, this has been such an incredible conversation. I look forward to seeing how it continues to evolve and how the conversation just keeps going. And I know that it's probably a crazy time for you, kind of tough. I'm not sure if you anticipated this much commentary, but I know all of us really appreciate the work that you've done. I will be sure to post your social accounts so folks can follow you and keep up with, what's going on and get more of that, juicy info on a regular basis. So thanks again so much. I am really excited to hear what's next for the three of you. And I'm so grateful that you joined me today.
Thanks so much, Teresa.
Thanks for having us.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. And if you'd like to regain control of your metabolic health and feel like yourself again, check us out at virta.com. That's VIRTA.com. Your Life Reset is for informational purposes only and shouldn't be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Contact your provider if you suspect you have a medical problem. I'll chat with you all again soon. Until then, stay inspired, my friends.